Everyone, thank you for tuning in. This is the first Superfund Redevelopment Initiative webinar of 2018. As Gene mentioned, my name is Michelle Mahoney. I work in Superfund, and I'm sitting in for Melissa Friedland, who is the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative Program Manager. She was ill today, not able to join us, so I'll be giving her introductory slides and assisting with the moderation of the question and answer period of today's session. I'm really glad everyone is here, and we're going to talk about industrial redevelopment and how it can be brought to Superfund sites. So the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative, which is referred to as SRI, hosts these webinars as part of a quarterly webinar series about the redevelopment of Superfund sites. These SRI webinars share site reuse success stories as well as challenges, and with the hopes that these stories will inspire you in looking at your consideration of reuse at other blighted properties. Each webinar provides some guidance, tools, and lessons learned, and all of this is to support the appropriate reuse of Superfund sites. I will mention that we have been doing these SRI webinars since 2009, which was SRI's 10th anniversary, and all of those previous webinars, including this one, once we were completed, you can find in our archives at cluin.org, and we have those links to that in the related URLs. So here on the slide, you see a preview of what we're going to be covering today. Our webinar is centered on the successful industrial reuse of Superfund sites. Before we get into our discussion and the case studies, I want to share a little bit about EPA's Superfund Redevelopment Initiative. Then we're going to hear from Marla Weeder from Region 2 about the history and redevelopment of the Buckby Mears non-MPL site in Cortland, New York. Marla's going to talk about the cleanup and reuse of a former electrical component manufacturer into a modernized space for manufacturing, warehousing, and light industrial activities. And then we'll have Casey Luckett-Snyder, who is the SRI coordinator from EPA Region 6, Edgar Berteau from TEX-TIN Steering Committee, Bob Panuski from Project Navigator, and Christy Unzicker from Genesis Energy present on the collaborative work that they did that allowed for the industrial reuse of the TEX-TIN Corp Superfund site in Texas City, Texas. And then after their presentation, I'm going to share with you some more resources and contact information related to Superfund redevelopment. So the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative works with communities and other partners in considering future reuse opportunities and integrating appropriate reuse options into the cleanup process. It's important to note that reuse considerations can and should be explored at any point during the Superfund cleanup process. There's lots of different ways to reuse Superfund sites. There's no one size fits all solution to determine which reuse type will be most appropriate. And contaminated sites like the two we'll talk about today pose very unique challenges in terms of both cleanup and reuse. However, this can allow for a broad spectrum of safe and productive reuse possibilities. The EPA's primary mission is to protect human health and the environment, and returning contaminated sites to productive use is an important part of that mission. Reuse is a priority for EPA, and it's an integral part of the agency's strategic plans and goals. In May of 2017, our EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt established the Superfund Task Force to provide recommendations for improving and expediting site cleanups and promoting redevelopment. Since then, the Superfund Task Force has developed recommendations for action and is diligently working to see the goals realized. There are several efforts underway, and EPA will share tools as they become available. And if you're interested in finding out any more information about this task force, you can check out some of the links that are in the resources pod, which is on the right-hand middle part of the screen. For more information about any of the SRI's reuse and redevelopment efforts, I encourage you to visit the SRI website, and that link is also here on the slide and in the resources provided with the seminar. And I'll just point out, we have two pictures here of two sites that are in reuse. On the left is the Martin Marietta Sodieco Superfund site in Region 4, and this site now supports a variety of industrial reuses with consideration for wildlife as well. And on the right is Prologis and other businesses that are built in a cap on top of the PJP landfill Superfund site in Region 2. One other thing I want to share with you is that EPA also encourages you to check out our redevelopment partnerships page on our SRI website. Here you can learn more about specific organizations that SRI is partnered with to assist with these Superfund site reuses. And we found that collaborating with these organizations helps SRI provide appropriate tools and resources to turn reuse visions and plans into reality. Currently, SRI has partnerships with the Academy of Model Aeronautics, the U.S. Soccer Foundation, the Rails to Trails Conservancy, the Trust for Public Land, and the Pollinator Partnership. And I'll mention that if you look at the archived webinars, you'll find webinars that we've done with each of these organizations on sites that have been reused. These organizations are very familiar with Superfund, and they're willing to work with communities, municipalities, and other stakeholders to explore reuse opportunities and resources for their local Superfund sites. So as Jean mentioned during today's presentation, please feel free to ask questions. You can do this by typing them in the question and answer pod. Jean also mentioned that if you could let us know who the question is for, which speaker, or if there's any slide that you're referring to please be clear about that. We are going to have questions after each section, but we might hold some of the questions if we think that future presenters will address them. And we'll also have time at the end for any remaining questions. And with that, I would like to turn the session over to Marla, who's going to start off our discussion of successful industrial reuse of Superfund sites with the Bucketing Mears non-MPL site.
Hi, great. Thank you so much. I hope the audio is good. I'm dialing in internationally, so if anybody has any issues, I guess just put it in the question box and I'll try to speak up for you. Hopefully the program is loading in a sec. This is the Buckby Mears Coast site, and this is really a condensed version for you. This was a several-year process with everybody, but I think it was a good cleanup and redevelopment story. It certainly was a story that I felt very good about. I've been with the Superfund program for, less than 25 years, but getting up there. So, I've had a lot of experience with removals, a lot of experience with remedial sites, but this was one I felt really good about, and I think it was illustrative on how the Superfund process can really dovetail with reuse, which at least, I can't speak for all the regions, but I think in a lot of cases with Superfund, we're very focused on getting the cleanup done, getting cost recovery. It's not so much a focus on reuse, and I really think this is an important part of our process because, what exactly is the point of doing a cleanup and, spending all this money, time, and resources if it's actually not going to go back into redevelopment? So I think this is such an important part of our program. So the Buckby Mears site, this unfortunately was quite a big site we came upon. This is upstate New York. For those that are not really familiar with upstate New York, in Cortland, New York, there is a swath that kind of runs through New York, which is our old industrial corridor. It's kind of our little rust belt. A lot of old industry, had left the area. There was a lot of agriculture mixed in, but, really light industrial. A lot of industry had gone out over the years. And not a real hot real estate market either. So turning a site like this around was not easy. So Buckby Mears the company, what exactly did they do? From about the 1970s through about 2004, they manufactured different electronic components, mostly these aperture masks, which I'm not even exactly sure what they are, but they're a component in color TVs and the old computer screens. It's an older technology for computer monitors, computer screens when they were really big. So, needless to say, with an old technology, they were losing money. They were a big company at one time, and unfortunately, they fell into bankruptcy. Oddly, what happened in this case is when everybody was outsourcing work to India, a company from India actually decided they thought it was a good idea to relocate to upstate New York, which doesn't make any sense whatsoever when you understand the exchange rate between India and New York. I don't know how that happened exactly. There are a lot of mysteries in the site, but they only operated for about a year, and then they just abandoned ship. Not surprisingly, they couldn't make a go in upstate New York. Now, why did we get called in? Unfortunately, this is what the site looked like when they left it after a year. And it was never really clear kind of what condition the prior owner had left it in. It was a bankruptcy. The site was sold very quickly in the bankruptcy process, as is, to a company that I'm not sure how much they had actually seen the site or knew about the site. As you can see, those pictures on the bottom of the screen, that shows what the property looked like on the outside. There was scrap everywhere. There was all kinds of process lines, machinery. There were containers that contained actually some pretty significant hazardous substances, which is why the police had initially called us. There was some vandalism there. There were tanks. They said, somebody better get out here and do something. We're really concerned about the site. The two pictures in the upper part of the screen, the one on the left, you can see the ceiling that's covered with black mold, and that was a huge building, hundreds of thousands of square feet in that building. It was just covered in black mold because there had been a leak, unfortunately, over the winter. So, and then you can see the other picture, too, on the right of the screen. There was all kinds of pipe and process lines and machinery and waste sitting everywhere. I had a lot of pictures, but those were just a few. So initially, we had started talking with the India company. We actually had a live body to talk to. Pretty soon, guess what happened? Everybody went back to India, and we had nobody left to talk to. So we had a PRP that just abandoned the site. We were left with some strange characters to deal with, some people we weren't even sure really represented the company, particularly an attorney that came in to talk with us, and we couldn't even get him to say whether or not he really represented the company. Oh, no. My connection seems to be lost. I hope everybody can hear me still.
Yes, you can, and your audio is coming through nice and clear.
Okay. Can you still see the screen?
We can, and if you've had a lag on your end, it's okay. Your controls will come back in a moment. Otherwise, I just encourage you to keep speaking verbally, and we
okay.
can
see
the slide for you.
You got it. So you were on the screen that showed all the pictures of the site. Please go to the next one if somebody can, the EPA removal action. So EPA, and so hopefully you can see the map of the site, the parcels.
Yes, we have that up.
Excellent. Thank you. Sorry, mine is not up. So EPA undertook a removal action at the site, and it did take us several years to do this. Unfortunately, the company then, when we were talking to them, they weren't exactly honest with us about what was at the facility. We thought that the process lines had been drained, some of the tanks were empty, some of the other processing tanks had been, you know, emptied of their contamination too. Guess what? Of course, that wasn't the case. By the time we got there and it was starting to go to winter, pipes started bursting because the lines, of course, were full, and we had a much bigger mess on our hands than we originally anticipated. So after several years of undertaking a removal action, EPA was in about $8 million in the hole. If you could go to the next slide, redevelopment challenges and solutions. We had a lot of challenges on this site. Obviously, we had an owner who was now back in India. We had encumbrances on the property like you wouldn't believe. We had about $17 million all in between EPA's response lien, city lien, county tax lien. Bank of India also had a mortgage on the site. The building interior, it was an absolute maze. The configuration was terrible. It had extensive mold. They left all kinds of equipment and processing materials all over the place. Also, after we undertook the removal action, there were slabs that were still at the site from some of the buildings we took down and subsurface soils as well. We did have some residual contamination in them, so we did have to do a management plan. To try to make sure anybody who would come on the site again, you know, that wouldn't be, you know, it wouldn't be an issue. Somebody wouldn't try to redevelop those areas. So we kind of hopped on that. So next slide, if you would, about the many stakeholders. We had a lot of stakeholders and a lot of dialogue in this case. International Electronic Devices, that was the former owner, of course, bankrupt, went back to India. EPA, we held liens on the property. At that point, it was about $8 million in Superfund removal costs. We had the State Bank of India involved, unfortunately, which held the mortgage to the site. And you better believe they did not want to foreclose on their lien and take this piece of property. The last thing they wanted to do was own a contaminated site in upstate New York when they were located in New Delhi. Then we had City of Cortland, who was the taxing authority. And they were actually very helpful, very involved. They also kept an eye on the site for us because, remember, there was also no site surveillance initially. And there was vandalism. There were people getting on the site, and the site was an absolute disaster. So they were actually very helpful in sending the police and the fire department by periodically. The county, they also have an industrial redevelopment agency. And they were very involved with us as well, very involved in the process. And we then had somebody who was coming in as a realtor who was very interested in the property and, you know, was kind of part of the dialogue going, you know, going back and forth. They were definitely interested in it, if it was the right price, and also, you know, if, you know, we had to see how badly contaminated it was, too, because that was obviously going to affect their redevelopment options. So next slide, property encumbrances. So EPA, we had a lot of encumbrances, about $17 million at that point. EPA had about an $8.3 million lien on the site. The Bank of India had over that, you know, it was 8.4 and going with interest. And then there was also the taxing authorities were the other two major lien holders. But there was a bunch of other junior liens, and that was like workers that weren't paid and, you know, different mechanics liens and other things else on the property. So it was really encumbered. Next slide, please, about getting to unencumbered. Because that was where we were really trying to figure things out. How do we kind of clear the site so somebody really wants to take it on? Because nobody wanted to take on the site as it was. So we did spend a lot of time and a lot of money and a lot of dialogue with all the stakeholders at that point because, you know, we were on the phone literally every day talking about new options and possibilities here. And several of the tools we ended up using the reuse assessment through the SRI program, a CERCLA 122H agreement with the bank, because we did a lot of talking with the bank who had, you know, essentially had no idea what Superfund was, who had never owned a site like this, who certainly did not want to foreclose and take this site, who didn't know what to do with the principals that they gave like $10 million to start this thing. So we also, you know, really had to walk them through the process, too. We also did two MOAs, which I'll talk about, which is kind of key to getting this done. And a lot of dialogue, a lot of trust with the localities, and, you know, a lot of creativity when the dust settles. People gave us a lot of latitude, thankfully, with headquarters and everybody on this site, because this was a tough nut to crack. So the next slide is on reuse assessments, and this is one we had done with SCIO. And we used it very strategically, and SCIO helped us finalize a brochure and a PowerPoint on the site. It was a very simple brochure, but it actually put together, you know, all the major key components of the facility and the property surrounding it and everything that might attract a potential buyer. It was just so well done and so simple and laid out everything that you would want in a pamphlet. I really loved it. And they also did a nice PowerPoint, which was very helpful for the municipalities and the folks that were trying to get some kind of interest from some kind of any kind of company that might come in, create jobs, put in something that wasn't a scrapyard in the area. They just wanted somebody to help the tax base up there, maybe give a few jobs, but they really wanted the site in reuse. And so the IDA, the localities, they tried really hard to market this with us. And so the reuse assessment was really used as a great marketing tool by us, by the localities, even by the realtor. It was kind of the jumping off point. And so, you know, it wasn't much money. I think it was like $25,000. And when we already poured $8 million into the site, this was like nothing to jumpstart this. And I also want to mention, it's not in the slides, but we also there was also a BOA process going on at the same time up there. There was another federal Superfund site, a corridor that they kind of wanted to redevelopment to. So there was this brownfield opportunity area kind of process going on. So the municipalities in this area were pretty sophisticated and, you know, pretty savvy with some of the tools that they could use up there. So this was all kind of part of the dialogue that we were having. So it was very useful because the BOA process kind of dovetailed nicely with what we were doing, and it was in an area nearby, so a potential buyer could see, you know, wow, there's a lot of potential in this corridor. So the next slide is the CERCLA 122H settlement slide. I'll just mention really briefly, EPA and the bank signed on to a settlement agreement. And, you know, it's essentially our 122H model, except it was a little different because it was a bank, and we have that lender liability thing. And this was a little where it got a little touchy with the bank. We had to say, look, at the end of the day, you gave them a lot of money. We're not sure why. What we don't want to do is give you a 104E or open up all your bank records and see if this was really like an arm's length transaction here. And, you know, we could go through this process or you could try to work with us on something. Because it was a little fishy what happened, and we were never quite sure what the deal was, but we said, you know what, if we can get them at the table, they'll work with us, they'll give up their lien, everybody can, you know, essentially count their losses and go home and let this property be back into reuse, we'll all be happy with that. So they did agree to sign on to a settlement agreement at the end of the day with us. It acknowledged there were all these competing liens out there, and since the bank was already starting to foreclose on the site, it didn't want it. But what it was going to try to do was foreclose and let it go right to auction, and if it didn't sell at auction, walk away. This was kind of a little bit of an odd process, and there was a lot of discussion on whether or not they could even do that, but we got everybody on board at the end of the day. But since it was already in process, we kind of let the process go forward. Next time I would never do that. If you're going into a situation on a foreclosure, always have the municipalities do the foreclosure. So the bank did put in some money for marketing and selling the site, and then the city and county taxes were paid back. And then we had a formula in there for if there were recovery of amounts over that, what percentage each of the stakeholders would get back. And really, both the settlement agreement and the MOAs acknowledged the fact that, look, there is a whole bunch of competing liens on this site, and we could all go to litigation about whose lien takes priority here. But, you know, at the end of the day, we're all getting cents on the dollar if we're lucky. So why don't we all agree to just say, look, let's make an agreement to just get the property foreclosed, clear the liens, put it into auction, and then we'll divide up the proceeds however meager they will be, and we will all go back home happy. And so that's what we had to get everybody's head around, that this was really the only way to do it. And so one of the things we did get in the settlement, which was good, the bank was going to pursue the principals back in India, which they did do. And EPA was going to get a share of any money they eventually recovered from the principals in India. Needless to say, that didn't pan out because they were extremely slippery even in India. And but also in the settlement, EPA did release the lien, and it said, you know, we're not going to go after you on any windfall liens. Next slide, please. Sorry, that's a little complicated. So. I think one of the most important things here I wanted to talk about is the memorandum of agreement. These are an animal out of Region 2. And what these are is we've done, let's see, with this site we've done 7 of them so far, and they've worked out really well for us. And essentially it's an acknowledgement that, look, the property is encumbered, it's frozen right now, we're all going to lose money, so let's try to figure out how to make this work. Let's all make an agreement. Let the municipalities foreclose, and then we'll divide up the proceeds. And we've done it different ways depending upon, you know, how much our liens were versus how much the municipalities' liens were. Sometimes once we did it with an industrial development agency that took the site, and these have been very successful with us. We've only done them on non-NPL sites, so when we've had these removal actions, And what essentially does, locality comes in and forecloses, sells the site at auction, and then there's some kind of cost share in there where there's a split between EPA, the locality, the IDA, the bank, whomever it is in process. And under that, we'll remove the CERCLA lien, waive our windfall lien. There is also the removal of lien eliminates EPA's one-year right of redemption that would be applicable if somebody foreclosed on EPA's lien, which is something a lot of people don't know about. But if a party forecloses on EPA's lien, we actually have a year that we could come back and object. I don't know how many times we've ever done that, maybe never, but it is something we can give up as consideration. To say, look, you can take this property free and clear of all liens, plus the federal redemption claims. We're not going to come after you, so you can immediately get financing, start to invest in the property, and not have to worry about it. Now, there's no action assurances, which we're not allowed to do, and that's fine because it's just an instrument that helps us clear title and get it back into reuse. And so next slide on the memorandum agreements. So we actually did two in this site. We did it with the county and with the city, and the process worked well. It ended up, in this case, the bank foreclosed since they were already headed down that road, but the property did sell at auction, and the buyer took it, the realty company that was very interested in it. And they invested, I think, about $400,000 when the dust settled in the property. They cleaned up the mold. They cleaned up the property a bit. They did some cosmetic stuff, and then they did some stuff that, you know, we couldn't reach, like the black mold. That stuff we couldn't use Superfund money for. And also the slide notes that there are five others we have done. And we have been able to get the property sold and back into reuse. Next slide, please. And this is what the site looked like after. This is the much improved Buck Beamier's ready for reuse. It's now called the Cortland Industrial Center, and it is being marketed. I think they had tenants before, and they're looking for somebody a little more permanent. There were some. There's a deal discussion in progress right now to get somebody, I think, on most of the site, which is actually a pretty big site at 75 acres. So folks are very hopeful on that. So, you know, all in, the site, you know, I felt really good about the site, and I think what I felt really good about, too, was working with the municipalities on the site. They really, really trusted EPA, and they really appreciated us, and we really saw how important it was to get them back this tax money, but most importantly, to get the site cleaned up and so somebody would be able to come back on there, maybe bring some jobs, help the tax base in the area, and get this whole industrial corridor cleaned up. So it really helped spur that, too. And it folded in nicely with their BOA area as well. So it engendered a lot of good feelings towards EPA. So that's always positive when we can do something like that. So I think that's all I really had to say about Buckbee. And that's, you know, a real condensed version of about 5 or 6 years of some tough negotiations and some creativity on the site. But, you know, financially it was a loser for us, but in every other respect it was a real winner, and I'm still happy with Buckbee. So if you have any questions, next slide, questions or comments, you can ask me either online or after this. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Marla. We did get a couple questions that came in while you were speaking, so we'll just take a minute here to maybe ask you a couple of them.
Sure.
We have someone who wants to know how EPA brought all the stakeholders to the table, especially the international-based stakeholders.
Yeah, the international-based one did not want to go. The India company, IED, did not come to the table after a while. I guess they just thought, forget this. We're just going to go back to India. Nobody's going to chase us there. And they were right. EPA wasn't going to chase them, but the State Bank of India was. Thankfully, the State Bank of India, which is located in Mumbai, has a New York City office. And they had an attorney assigned to this who knew absolutely nothing about Superfund. And they really didn't want to own the site. And they already started the foreclosure proceedings. And everybody was kind of frozen at that point. They're like, we don't even really understand this. We don't want the site. We think we can just send it to auction but not take ownership of it. Like, whoa, come on over to our office. We need to talk. And so I spent a lot of time with the bank and the bank's attorney, and they sent a number of people over from Mumbai at any given time for our discussions. And, you know, it was really a process of educating them about Superfund, talking to them about how much money we had already put into the site, what we were doing to try to get it back into reuse, and doing the reuse assessment, and how we were trying to, you know, EPA market with a small M, but we were, you know, getting the marketing materials out to everybody to try to encourage everybody, you know, hey, talk up this site. You know, we're ready to talk with anybody who wants to talk Busby. So it was really tough getting them to the table and getting them to understand everything. Obviously, the municipalities came to the table right away, and they're like, what can we do here? You know, how can we help? You know, we're going to spread the word. Give us the materials. We'll do a town meeting. We'll do this, you know. So they were great. We didn't get everybody at the table at the same time, so it was a lot of EPA going back and forth and back and forth and back and forth to try to do these settlements, but we made it work down to the wire, you know, thankfully for those September deadlines.
Right. Okay, and we have another question about the reuse evaluation and that related process. At any point, was there any analysis done of the site's economic potential?
Was there any what of the site's economic potential?
Just analysis.
I didn't hear that.
Any
analysis of it? Not on our end, and I think to a limited extent there was in the reuse assessment. The reuse assessment did talk about obviously some of the possible uses for the property because it was such a big parcel and where it was located, and it did have a rail spur, and so the reuse assessment did do a nice job on kind of, you know, I think kind of maybe, I don't know, maybe opening up the discussions a little bit for everybody or having them think a little bit out of the box on what it might be used for. I'm not sure there was any real economics done in there. There you go.
Okay. We have another question about the MOAs and if they're enforceable.
We'd like to think so. I'll say this, I guess. They're an agreement that's freely entered into between EPA and the municipalities, and it's something we all want to do. And, you know, it avoids litigation. It frees up the site for redevelopment. It gets the property unencumbered. This is something, you know, these tax liens are very complicated. And I know some of it is, you know, and this is certainly not my field at all, but we did a lot of analysis and a lot of legal research on the circularity of liens and first in time, first in right, and it gets very complicated when you try to figure out who has priority over what. And there was very good arguments that, you know, the taxing jurisdiction had, you know, priority, but there was an argument EPA had priority in some cases, or if you do it by year, that money was expended. And, it, you know, when we got into the research, it was very difficult to try to figure this out. And we did have a few tough talks with the taxing jurisdictions. And, you know, at the end of the day, we all said, look, we all have pretty good arguments here. We all have case law we could show and try to argue that we have priority on X or Y. But you know what? Let's not do that, because this site, we're not getting any money back. You know, what exactly is the point? Let's just agree that we should go to foreclosure, sell it at auction, and divide it up based upon, you know, whatever kind of formula we came up with. And in this one, it's a little more complicated. Some of them we just went like 50-50. But I think it's been very effective. And I think, you know, we do MOAs with other jurisdictions. Now, if the jurisdiction backed out, I mean, there's no, like, penalty provision or anything that says, oh, you backed out, you know, we're going to come after you. It's not like that. It's just two governments essentially agreeing to go forward in this manner, and it's been effective. So, you know, fingers crossed.
Okay, great. Thanks, Marla. Very interesting case study that you presented. I think we're going to move on to our second case study, but we may have time for more questions at the end of our seminar. So, Marla, if you could hang on to the end, that would be great in case we have any more questions for you.
I'll try my best. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Marla. So next up, we're going to hear about the Tex-10 Superfund site. So I'm going to turn it over to Bob Berto, who's going to start talking about that site for us.
Thank you. First, we'd like to say thank you to EPA and the other presenters for bringing this together today. On behalf of the Tex-10 Steering Committee and Project Navigator, both we're pleased and honored to be here to share information on the Tex-10 Superfund site and the redevelopment of the site. My name is Bob Panuski, and I work for Project Navigator. I'm the project coordinator for the Tex-10 Settling Defendants, which is the group of companies who conducted the investigation and cleanup of the site. We worked closely with EPA, who controlled the site during the remedial action, and Genesis, who ultimately came in and redeveloped the site. I've been associated with the site since 2000. Today, we're going to be covering three main topics. The first will be a brief history of the Tex-10 smelter, followed by an overview of the remedial action that was conducted at the site. But really, today's primary focus will be on how we worked closely with EPA and Genesis both during the redevelopment of the site. This photo here shows some of the old smelter buildings and the stack, and as you can see, it was quite a sight. The site itself is located about an hour south of Houston, Texas, in a very heavily industrialized part of the city of Texas City, Texas. It's just down the road from the former BP refinery that you may have heard of. I'm always taken by the first bullet here. The smelter was constructed in 13 months for less than $4 million. So as you can imagine, that was quite a while ago. The smelter was really the only one in the United States and was quite integral to our war effort during World War II for supply of tin. The smelter continued to operate during or after the war under private ownership until around 1991. At its peak, I understand that it actually produced 45% of the world's tin. So it was quite a prolific smelter, obviously. From there, after the private companies went bankrupt in 91, it sat until it entered into the Superfund program. This slide, you can see an aerial of the site pre-remedy from the late 90s. I would imagine that a lot of the folks on the phone have been involved in Superfund sites, and I think many times you'll agree that you get out to the site and it looks relatively innocuous, a field, something like that. But probably one of the best descriptions I've heard of Tex-10 is that it's a Superfund site on steroids in the early stages. As you can see, there were piles of slag, some of it 40 feet high, wastewater ponds. This pond here had 16 million gallons of a liquid with a pH of less than 2, and then many, many smelter buildings that were up in this area. All these buildings contained materials and drums that needed to be characterized and managed, and it was quite an effort. This slide shows you some more details on the original site conditions if you're interested, and you can really see that virtually every part of this site, 140 acres, needed to be addressed during the site remedy. So the history of the site, after some years of initial investigations, the site was finally listed on the NPL in 1998. An investigation was followed by a focused feasibility study that ultimately determined the remedy in the year 2000. The Textin settling defendants entered into a consent decree statement of work with EPA, and the cleanup began in 2001. It was about a two-year process that was conducted under in a phased approach using the design-build process. So that really allowed us to get started on remedy construction by addressing things that were relatively simple while we were studying and designing the more complex parts of the remedy. So, for example, we were able to go out and start knocking down buildings while we were finalizing the design of RCRA caps and figuring out how we would deal with that 16 million gallon pond of PH2 liquid. This was the design build process, and the phased approach really was a key factor in helping us complete the work ahead of schedule and under the EPA cost estimate in the feasibility study. This is a list of some of the metrics associated with the cleanup. And as you can see, there was a wide variety of things that were addressed: drums, lab chemicals, explosive lab chemicals, sludge stabilization. We constructed RCRA caps, dealt with principal threat soils, waste ponds, NORM, et cetera, et cetera. In addition, we dropped a 250-foot tall stack, which was quite an exciting event. The remedy itself really was essentially a water management remedy. Slurry walls, impermeable walls along the east and western side of the sites, and then the down gradient side was lined with a, 366 evapotranspiration trees to help with groundwater control. After the remedy was completed, we covered the entire site with a clay soil cover, a vegetated clay soil cover to help evapotranspiration and minimize infiltration. And currently, we are in an operating and maintenance mode conducting annual groundwater sampling. So that's really just the broad overview of the remedial action. And I think the main takeaway from this is that it was quite an investment by the PRPs in the cleanup of the site. And as we'll talk about in later slides, protecting that investment, protecting the remedy, really was quite critical during the redevelopment of the site. So that is a real brief overview of the remedial action. And from here, I'll turn it over to Edgar Berto, who is the chairman of the Textin Steering Committee. And Edgar will walk us through some of the redevelopment considerations during remedy design and construction.
Thank you, Bob. Again, my name is Edgar Berto. I'm the chair of the Textin Steering Committee. I've been involved with the site even longer than Bob, since about 1999. Bob alluded to that the process for the design of the remedy was we went through a design construct. It was a very streamlined approach. We heard early on from EPA that they were very interested in redevelopment. Now, as far as the steering committee and the settling defendants, we didn't own the site anymore. So my attitude really was, so what's in it for us? I mean, why should we facilitate redevelopment? Any value that we add to the property, we're not going to get any money out of this. Nevertheless, the EPA RPM, Carlos Sanchez, indicated it was very important to him. And so if it was very important to Carlos, I thought we ought to at least listen. And so we engaged on that process. The example of the kind of process we went through, and part of the redevelopment process that Carlos is really pushing for, is getting it done, the remedy done quickly. we went from the original, the site was listed, delisted, and relisted. We went from the relisting to completion of the remedy in a little more than 5 years. And anybody who's involved in Superfund would find that period of time to be extremely short, especially given the site conditions. But that redevelopment vision really helped us guide the process and helps facilitate us working together. Bob alluded to that we went to a design construct process, and there were, I believe, 5 work packages. Basically, design for one was going on while work for the prior one was actually being conducted. We did the initial site layout of where the different remedy elements went, and rather than a detailed 30% design, and we wait 6 months for a response, and then a 95 and 100% design, we really had 2 design steps, a 30% design, which consisted of effectively a meeting where we all got together, we brought out drawings, we walked through them, and in the course of the 30% design for the site layout, Carlos said, well, why are you putting an orange cell in the middle of the site where it's going to impede redevelopment? Why don't you put the naturally occurring radioactive material site in the corner of the property so that it doesn't get in the way? And we moved it. Our contractor, who was also on board with this whole process, did not give us a change order for having to haul material farther. So Recon was our contractor, and they're a big part of the success as well. One of the other things we did in working with the site trustee, who represented effectively represented the owners of the site, had some interest in some water well equipment, and so we agreed to preserve that during the course of the remedy. And after the remedy, we had put into place institutional controls. These institutional controls protected the remedy. You can't read all the things in the right-hand side there, but the different areas of the site had different. There are 6 or 7 zones that we had different sets of mechanisms in place to protect the remedy. Zones 1, 2, and 3 were different areas. The remedy was basically a containment remedy. I mean, the acid pond, yes, that was treated, but the majority of the materials were such that it could be covered. So the vast majority of the site is a cover, and it's 2 feet of clay soil. Bob alluded to that there's a water management, so that we don't want water percolating through that, but the materials were norm slag, non-norm slag, non-slag norm. Some of the materials were stabilized, but again, the vast majority were covered. An example of the way we worked together on appropriate implementation is we had a material that was a vitreous slag material, and it was, if you ran a TCLP test on it, it would fail. And as you know, typically when you have a metal bearing material that fails for TCLP, you do some kind of stabilization like mixing with concrete. So we had a discussion with EPA where we said, hey, this material is vitreous. So in order to treat it, we would take it, grind it all up, mix it with concrete, and make it solid again. How about we skip all that? It's stable now because it's already in a glass-like state, and we'll just handle it as being treated. And it was recognized that that was a appropriate resolution of the issue. So some of the areas of the site, some of them have clay soil cover that we did use. There are some building foundations, slabs left, and since our remedy was effectively a containment remedy, we just used those rather than having to break up the concrete for the purpose of covering it back up again. There were some areas that were not to be disturbed going forward. There's a norm cell, as I indicated, in the southwest corner of the site. There was an existing, prior to the implementation of the remedy, a low-level radioactive waste landfill. Some of the materials were I say there were some materials that were stabilized, hazardous waste that was stabilized, so we had created a cell for that. And there was a what we call a consolidation cell, which is like building debris and so forth, that was not hazardous waste but still needed to be handled a little more carefully than having just a cover over it. And again, the institutional control plan was part of a whole package of describe how to protect the remedy going forward. So we completed the remedy in approximately 2005. As you can see, the site looks even then a whole lot better than it did in the picture that Bob showed you. And then some of the site features are, as I indicated, the norm cell, the low-level radioactive waste landfill, the barrier walls on either side of the site, the slurry walls. And the pond 7 was where we had hazardous waste, and the consolidation cell was the other material. And these all were called out, and then effectively the balance of the site was available for redevelopment. And this picture was taken before the full evapotranspiration system was established. There was a set of trees along the southern boundary to pick up water so it doesn't leave the site. And then throughout the site, by combination of site grading and grass, water that it falls on the site is either drains off or is evaporated as part of the grass growing to reduce the water flow through the site. Anyway, since 2005, we continue to monitor the site, mow the grass, check on the site, and there were EPA remedy reviews. So part of our focus as far as future of the site was reducing, reducing the amount of maintenance we have to do in the site. The remedy doesn't require a lot of action, but it does require a certain amount of vigilance, maintaining the caps. As you know, when grass grows, next thing you know, you have trees growing, and trees aren't so very good for integrity of caps, so they have to be taken care of. Like if there's a fence around the property, all site security, all those things. And one of our interests in the redevelopment was if somebody else is on the property using it productively, we don't have to watch it or pay to watch it. And with that, I will turn the presentation over to Christy Unziger with Genesis.
Hi, everybody. My name is Christy Unziger. I guess this wasn't my slide, but I guess you're done with that, Edgar? Sorry.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I meant to... Christy, I'm sorry. I should have taken that one.
That's okay.
Thank you for that. I'll just take this one. Thank you, sir. So this is, again, a brief timeline. I think we've covered all this. The remedy was worked. The actual implementation of remedy was over 120,000 man without incident. And this was completed 9 months ahead of schedule for millions less than EPA's original cost estimate. One of our partners in this process was RECON, and they really owned the site and acted like they owned the site, and part of that was really effectively implementing the remedy and doing so safely. I personally really came to an understanding of why safety was so important, because it really helped pull RECON together and help them own the site and own the process. And if they're paying attention to what they're doing, they're going to implement the remedy safely, implement it effectively, and implement it in a timely manner. So the fact they did it in 2003 for reuse, 75% of the site what became available. Ready for reuse determination by EPA, which helped them. The property is located in Texas City, It is ideally located because it's served by rail. There's pipelines through the area. It's in a heavily industrial area. So the property had quite a bit of value, and it's a large parcel. And in 2016, we commenced discussions with Genesis about reuse of the vast majority of the property. Okay to turn it over to you, Christy?
Yeah, I think so. Okay,
Thank you.
My name is Christy Enziker. I'm the Manager of Environmental Compliance with Genesis Energy. So out of all the hard work that everyone did, we built the Texas City Terminal on a section of the Tex-10 site. It's a crude oil terminal that receives and stores crude oil and delivers it by pipeline to local markets. So we weren't looking for a reuse project. It was never on my list of things to do. But this is an ideal site given its location to existing pipelines and infrastructure such as electricity that it was kind of hard to pass up. When our business development team originally came to me and said this is where they wanted to build, I was a little nervous. Then I did some more research and saw the ready for reuse determination, and that got me a little bit more comfortable. And then we started discussions with EPA and the steering committee, and they were so positive that we could do this, and they were so willing to help that it made me believe it too. So, and ultimately, obviously, it was a success. And not only that, we did this in a little over a year. We built this terminal, and we couldn't have done it if we didn't all work together, if EPA, steering committee, project navigator weren't willing to help us and review work plans as quick as they possibly could. We took steps to minimize the amount of impact we would have, even if it was maybe a little bit more expensive in terms of construction. So we all really worked together just to get it done and to make it work. So there's large tanks on this site. There are pipelines that we installed by horizontal directional drilling, which you can see on the picture with the yellow tarp. That's actually an entry pit for a HDD drill. So we dug pretty big pits and had to line them before we put these pipelines in. There's lots of interesting construction techniques that went on to get this site built. Another key thing that really helped us get through this is when we did run into unexpected things, and we did, there were surprises, that everybody worked together to come up with solutions. It wasn't just Genesis trying to come up with a construction solution and trying to get it approved. Everybody offered ideas, and we were able to get through everything. So we got it built, and then in November of 2017, EPA honored all of the partners with reuse recognition awards, and that included Texas City mayors who worked on the original cleanup, the steering committee, the site owner, project navigator, Recon who did the actual remedy, and then Genesis as the site developer. And this is kind of just an overview of the site with the new terminal built on it prior to being fully completed and revegetated. Obviously, the tanks aren't painted, but you can see we occupy just one corner of the site. And then I think we all have some lessons learned to go through. I know Bob had a couple he was going to address first, I believe.
Sure. Thanks, Christy. I'd like to just kind of start with the second bullet. It's kind of a cliche, but and really I think Carlos Sanchez with EPA helped out a lot in this vision of beginning with the end in mind. That goes back to one of the things Edgar was discussing where Carlos suggested we move the location of Norm Cell and you end up with more usable acreage. keeping the water well and the equipment. We developed a simple yet really effective grading plan that I think accomplished our goal of not having any standing water and minimizing infiltration, but still left the site relatively flat and better suited for future construction. So with that vision in mind, the remedy was constructed, and then Genesis came along and we began our real mantra of redevelopment, which was protect the remedy. And I know Christy probably got sick and tired of hearing it, but really I think that simple phrase, protect the remedy, became our mantra in essentially every discussion of scope or construction options. And I got to believe that I think all parties would say it was really a good guiding principle for the entire redevelopment project. Christy also mentioned that it wasn't on her list of things to do to do a reuse of a Superfund site. But, I think some of the early communications that we had to help ease her concerns and really demonstrate that both EPA and the steering committee were willing and able to help with our knowledge of the site conditions and minimize some of the risks during construction was very effective in helping her develop the plans and in risk and cost management. So just the back and forth early in the game so that she knew what she was getting into and we were able to convey where some of the potential concerns may be was very valuable to the overall redevelopment. She also mentioned that developing the work plans was a collaborative process. Using the knowledge of the experienced contractors, the institutional knowledge of the folks associated with the cleanup helped really facilitate some of the construction design and construction methods so that we were minimizing disturbances to the remedy and really minimizing some of the construction costs. I mentioned also that the use of the contractors with the knowledge and experience, Edgard and Christy both, I think, mentioned RECON, who was integral, was not only the main RDRA contractor, but was also retained by Genesis to help with some of the general construction activities during the redevelopment process. The last thing would be that, as Edgard said, what's in it for us, meaning the steering committee, one thing that's worked out quite well is that now that Genesis has redeveloped a portion of that property, they have taken over the responsibilities for the maintenance of the grass. So, now we have less grass to cut and reduced costs to the steering committee. So as you probably know, that's always a good thing. So I think it was a big combination of all these things, but really overall the Texton site shows that redevelopment can be very successful and beneficial to everybody involved. On the PRP side, I think it's important for PRPs to continue to stress the importance of protecting the remedy and being open to changes, which can increase the likelihood and the ease, if you will, of redevelopment. On the Genesis side, I think it's important for her to understand, or for any redeveloper, to understand site conditions and ask the right questions, and to recognize that the PRPs have invested millions of dollars into this remedy, and they really want to protect it. So overall, I think we had a great team on this project. Communication and teamwork really led to what Carlos says is a model for Superfund success. So that's it for our slides. Thank you very much.
I was going to add one thing to that, Bob. I think the line I use is it's really a Superfund success story. I think people think that's an oxymoron, but and redevelopment, having the vision for redevelopment and working together really helped it become a Superfund success story. And keying on your last bullet there of going forward, I think any of us who've been in with Superfund cleanup for a while recognize you do the remedy, you get it done, and then you've got this O&M period that goes on, well, somewhere between 30 years and forever, I think. And having the site have value is going to really serve those of us who are paying for the remedy but don't own the site value going forward. So facilitating redevelopment is really a good long-term strategy. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Was there anyone else who was part of the site that wants to make any more comments before we move on to questions?
Hi, can y'all hear me?
Yes.
Hi, this is Sarah Dalton from Chevron. I'm the co-chair of the steering committee, and I'm probably the newest member of the PRP group that's been involved with Genesis. And I just want to say how important I think it is, the continuity of the team that's worked on the site. I've learned so much from Edgar and Bob based on their long history with the site, their institutional knowledge. And I think that from what Christy indicated, that's gone a long way to being, agile with answering questions and understanding the site rather than just, handing over massive documents and trying to get your head around the situation through a paper exercise. I think the human element should not be underestimated, how important that is to reuse.
Okay, thank you for that. Anyone else, any of the speakers, or anyone associated with this site? Okay, great. Well, we did get a number of questions that came in while you guys were presenting, so I think we'll take a few moments here to kind of go through those. We have a participant who has asked some questions about the waste that was removed from the smelter and wants to know how some of the waste was disposed of and characterized as it was being disposed. And I guess maybe some information about, the methods that were used for disposal?
Sure. So with regards to the demolition, a lot of the material was sent for recycling off-site, as you can imagine, steel from the buildings, et cetera. But they also contained just a huge variety of chemicals that were characterized on site and disposed of off site, most of it during a lab pack. And then there were 7,500 drums that needed to be characterized and identified. We sent a lot of stuff off site, basically.
Okay.
I was just going to say that. That was for the building demo. There was asbestos-containing material that was disposed of in the on-site cell. A lot of the rest of the building debris was in the on-site consolidation cell. And as I alluded to earlier, the slag, the norm was put in the norm cell. The slag, a lot of it was basically spread around and covered with clay. The material that was stabilized, there was a RCRA waste, went in the RCRA cell on-site. So other than, the initial building demolition, a lot of material was disposed of off-site, but subsequent to that, the vast majority was put into some of the ponds and covered or as necessary, stabilized.
Yeah, we just received a specific question. Someone wanted to know about the acidic water disposal.
That was an interesting exercise as well. It was basically treated in the pond itself. And Bob will help me if I get the details wrong here, a lot of sodium hydroxide was added. and that raised the pH. Now, in doing so, I mean, there was the people working on the cleanup weren't there during the operation, so they didn't know exactly. We didn't know exactly what was in there. We knew the pH was very low. When we started to raise the pH, we started to smell ammonia, and ammonia comes out of solution when you raise the pH. So we figured out there was a lot of ammonia in it. That water was ultimately treated and discharged, and through using the permit limits in the NPDES permit for the site. But that NPDES permit did not call out ammonia limits. So we had a discussion about, okay, so once we get done treating this water, how do we discharge it? And what ammonia limits should we do, and what should we do to treat it? And we came to, we had routine meetings, like pretty much during the heat of things, monthly meetings at the site with EPA, and we came to the meeting and said, okay, we figured out that there's ammonia in this water, and we need to discharge it, and we're going to treat it. And we recommend that the discharge limits be the same as those that are for other facilities that discharge water to the same receiving stream, like wastewater plants have ammonia in their discharges. And we recommend this as a limit, and we'll treat it by taking and spraying the water into the air and collecting it, and that'll flash off the ammonia. And EPA right then and there said, we agree with the, I think either then or shortly thereafter, said, yes, that makes sense. So we basically encountered a problem. We worked to propose a solution, both from a remediation point of view and, again, a discharge standard point of view. And EPA reviewed it and agreed in a very quick manner. So, again, working together and working in a timely manner addressed it.
And I guess also related, what groundwater controls are now remain with Tex-10 and who's maintaining them?
We continue to the monitoring program is an annual monitoring program, for which, again, that's an O&M cost, and I think that's also a reasonable groundwater monitoring program. It's not, I mean, a lot of sites start out with quarterly monitoring, and you're wondering why you're collecting all this data. You're not really reacting to it. As we mentioned, the remedy is, in essence, water management, slowing the water down. the cleanup standards are, there's three zones. It's two shallower zones have higher allowable numbers. The deeper zone has sort of more statewide numbers. The standards are to achieve, not necessarily to achieve the standards, but rather to be on a trajectory towards achieving the standards. And as noted in the five-year review, we're not at that point. So we're still having the open issue for us now is what we do to, we're seeing increases in radionuclides at the Downmedium property. And so we have to, and some of our other monitoring wells. So that's actually the one point we have to, we're in the midst of a focus feasibility study for looking at that particular issue. But the Tex-10 Steering Committee is the one responsible for the groundwater monitoring and any remedies that we would have to implement.
Okay, thank you. We got a question here. Specifically asking Bob if you could speak to the significant ecological restoration and reuse associated with OU4 and the Natural Resources Trustees.
So OU4, the main drainage feature through the site was called Wachang Ditch. It ultimately discharged farther to the south in an area called Swan Lake. So there were some impacts to Swan Lake. As part of the overall settlement, the settling defendants and the U.S. government funded the construction of four breakwaters, really, out in Swan Lake to help sedimentation and cover those impacted materials. The most recent five-year review was just conducted last year, and that sedimentation is occurring, and the remedy is performing as designed. And if you go out there now, there are fishermen. It's a great fishing spot. It's lined with fishermen on a regular basis.
Okay, great. Well, thank you. I think we're going to present a few closing slides and a survey. I really want to thank all of our presenters today for your fantastic presentations. It was so good to hear about these redevelopment stories and how EPA and site stakeholders all work together to make reuse happen at these industrial sites. EPA really feels that showcasing these successful reuse projects is very important. And we found that sharing case studies and lessons learned is a great tool for promoting safe and beneficial reuse. I mean, you're helping other people learn from what you're doing. Stories like the ones we heard today allow us to demonstrate how resources can be used effectively, provide inspiration for those looking to reuse contaminated properties. So I want to thank everyone, all of our presenters, for the great work that you've done on these sites. I'm going to wrap up by just giving you some resources where you can find some more information, and then I'll turn it over to Jean Ballant, who's going to present a survey, and we really would like to hear from our participants and as we plan for future webinars. As I mentioned, this is a series of webinars, and we're always looking for topics that our audience is interested in. So as I mentioned at the beginning of our seminar today, SRI has a number of tools and resources available on our website that can help you as you consider reuse at your site. The SRI website is included as a link in the additional resources, which is you'll see on the related URLs pod here on your screen. And I also mentioned at the start that this webinar is a part of a series. Our next webinar is scheduled for April 17th, where we'll focus on case studies from SRI's regional seed program, showing how EPA supports Superfund site reuse that reflects the needs and desires of the community while also protecting human health and the environment. I wanted to let you know, as you see on the screen here, that SRI has a redevelopment coordinator in each EPA region, and that person works to support reuse at the site-specific level. If you'd like more information about an existing reuse project or would like to discuss reuse opportunities at mining sites or any site near you, please feel free to reach out to your regional coordinator. And as I also mentioned at the beginning, our Superfund National Program Manager for Redevelopment is Melissa Friedland, and Frank Avasado also is a project manager in this program. If you have any general questions or would like more information, their contact information is on this screen. Now I think I would like to pull up the survey that we put together where participants can let us know what you thought of today's session, give us your feedback on topics for future webinars, and then Jean's going to kind of, I guess, orient you through the survey.
Sure. Okay, so as Michelle said, we have a few questions that are up on the screen right now. We'll leave those up for just a few moments, so that you can provide some input on the direction of future webinar topics as part of the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative, or SRI. So you should see some questions and actually see some of the results as they're coming in live from the audience. Just simply asking what topics you might be interested in on future webinars, check off the box to the left of any topic that looks interesting to you. If you have specific topics or suggestions, perhaps that don't appear, or a site that you know of that you think might be a great fit for a future webinar, you can actually type in a comment to the right of that in the Suggest Future Webinar Topics box. If you would like to be informed when upcoming SRI webinars are open for registration and archives have been made available, you can also share your email address with us, and we'll add you to our distribution list when we announce these types of sessions. We do also have the related URLs available in the middle right of the screen. And I'll just walk through a couple of quick reminders and let you know that the presentation content is available to download from the seminar homepage or resource page. So if you scroll through the related URLs, links, find the seminar links or resource page, you should be able to click on it and then press the Browse To button to open it. I've also added that link in the questions window. So again, there's a link directly to where you can find those seminar slides. If anybody has any problems with that information, just let me know. And then the other question that we get a lot is, how can I get a participation certificate? So I will ask each of you to follow the link to our feedback form. And as long as you complete the online feedback form and let us know what you thought of today's session, you will have access to a box at the bottom of that feedback form, which will allow you to A, let us know what you thought of it, and then check to confirm that you were here for the entire session. As long as you check off the box that you were there for the entire session, once you submit the feedback form, you will immediately have access to a seminar participation certificate that you can save for your own record. If you happen to be there in the room with a group of people, each one of you can fill out that online feedback form and each get your own participation certificate, regardless if you had your own registration or you shared that with someone else. And if you happen to be one of the lucky ones replaying today's recorded webinar, guess what? Those links will still work for you. You can click on them and play them back to access the feedback and get your own participation certificate. So, as noted, today's session was recorded. You will automatically get an email once the archive is available. There are a collection of SRI webinars that are archived. I think I'm going to go ahead and call up those visuals now on the screen, since we seem to have gotten a number of feedback responses for future webinars. So again, I'm going to click over here and just remind everybody that the archived versions of the webinar are currently available for access. I believe there are over three dozen sessions that have been posted and made available on the SRI page on Cluin. And then, as I alluded to earlier, if you are interested in getting a participation certificate for today's session, please be sure to fill out